time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Richard Falk. Richard Falk is the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and visiting Distinguished Professor in Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. In 2001, he was appointed by the UN to serve on a three-person human rights inquiry commission for the Palestine territories, and in 2008 was appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council as a United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the Palestinian occupied territories. He serves as chair of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation's Board of Directors and as honorary vice president of the American Society of International Law. He is author of numerous books, including Indefensible Weapons, The Political and Psychological Case Against Nuclearism, co-authored with Robert J. Lifton, The Cost of War, International Law, the UN, and World Order After Iraq, and his latest book, Achieving Human Rights. Richard Falk, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Start out and talk about, you are the UN Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine. Tell us, what does that job entail?
Well, that's a job that basically entails reporting on the occupation that has been going on since 1967 of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And it involves trying to inform the General Assembly once a year and the Human Rights Council in Geneva once a year, and ideally visiting the occupied territories 2-3 times each year. Israel expelled me last December, and so I haven't been able to actually visit the occupied territories in the past year or so, but there's enough available information that I'm still able to give a fairly accurate and, I believe, truthful account of the relationship between the occupation and Israel's obligations under international humanitarian law, what are more popularly known as the Geneva Conventions. And that has been an underpinning for the more recent developments that have involved the so-called Goldstone Report that investigated, on behalf of the Human Rights Council, the Gaza war of last winter, 22-day war in which Israel attacked Gaza between December 27th and January 18th. And this recent development has given a lot of prominence both to the situation in the occupied territories and, in a less dramatic way, to my role as special rapporteur with a responsibility to report on the facts as they relate to the relevant law.
Right. Can you talk about the Goldstone Report and what its conclusions are?
The Goldstone Report is a very important and dramatic development in the tension between the United Nations and Israel. The Goldstone Report is named after Richard Goldstone, who is a South African jurist, a former member of the South African Constitutional Court, and a former prosecutor of war crimes at The Hague before the tribunal that was dealing with former Yugoslavia. He is also a lifelong Zionist, a religious Jew who has deep institutional connections with Israel, and was a member of the Board of Trustees of Hebrew University. I mention all that about his own background because he is probably the most sympathetic to Israel of any internationally credible figure that could have headed such an investigation of these allegations of war crimes. And the report investigates both Israeli war crimes and those attributed to Hamas. Of course, because the casualty totals reveal the comparative role of the two sides, more than 1,400 Palestinians died, more than 5,000 were injured, whereas Israel's total casualties amounted to 13. So it's not surprising, therefore, that the report itself concentrates on the Israeli violations of international humanitarian law. What the Goldstone report does is to confirm the impression that journalists and other human rights organizations had earlier established, that the Israeli attacks were violating international law because of being so indiscriminate and so irresponsibly directed at civilian targets, both human targets and the civilian infrastructure of a very poor, very crowded Gaza Strip. So the substance of the Goldstone report is really not so innovative or new. What is challenging to Israel in a way that it's never been challenged before are the recommendations. The recommendations suggest that those responsible for these war crimes should confront some kind of accountability. And it recommends, in a manner that has now been endorsed by the Human Rights Council, that the UN Security Council and General Assembly be given a responsibility to see that the recommendations of the report are implemented, and if they're not implemented voluntarily by Israel and Hamas, then the International Criminal Court in The Hague is instructed to inquire into these allegations to see whether a basis for prosecuting Israeli military and political leaders exists. Unlike any previous criticism from the UN directed at Israel, this has really challenged in a unprecedented way the legitimacy of the occupation that Israel has maintained since 1967 of the Palestinian territories. And the challenge appears to be very threatening to the existing governmental leadership, which has taken it extremely seriously, has contended that the report is one-sided and imbalanced, whereas the truth is that it's a very balanced report that gives Israel every benefit of the doubt, and if it is susceptible to criticism, it probably the failures of the report are somewhat associated with not taking some of the Palestinian grievances more seriously. For instance, during the 22 days of attack on an essentially defenseless society, the civilian population of Gaza was locked into the combat zone, which means that women and children, disabled, elderly, and so on, had no option to become refugees, to leave the combat zone. And this is very unprecedented, even under the conditions of the most rigorous warfare. Usually we see streams of refugees leaving war zones, as was recently the case in Pakistan. Been true throughout the Iraq War. So this element of locking the population into Gaza, it's a population of 1.5 million, 53% of whom are children, into a combat, intensely crowded area that had been subject to a blockade for a year and a half, is a kind of accentuation of the cruelty of warfare that one is aware of in any event. And I believe that when the facts are truly sorted out, the real casualties from this attack of last winter will not be just the 1,400 killed and the 5,000 or so wounded. It'll be all the civilian population that was traumatized in a manner that doesn't disappear with time, particularly the effects on children. Already psychologists in Gaza have reported that over 90% of the children were affected in a seriously harmful way so far as their mental health is concerned. So this war was almost most accurately described as a total war against the civilian population, and in that sense does violate the most fundamental limitations on the way in which warfare is conducted.
Israel claimed, and it's been often repeated in the U.S. corporate media, that it was the invasion was a self-defense move, that they were suffering an increase in rocket attacks. What's your response to that?
That is one of the most disturbing elements in the whole debate over both the Goldstone Report and the Gaza War. Because by Israel's own statistical material, which is available on the website of the Ministry of Defense and the Foreign Ministry, it is shown very clearly that the rocket fire from Gaza had fallen to practically zero during the several months that a temporary ceasefire had been negotiated under the auspices of Egypt. And this ceasefire was maintained by Hamas, even though Israel didn't live up to its side of the bargain, which was to ease the blockade on food, medicine, and fuel. So it was an impressive exhibition of a commitment to ending the violence along the border. And Hamas reinforced that kind of behavior by offering Israel a 10-year ceasefire, provided they did lift the blockade, which was an unlawful act to begin with, because a blockade on an entire impoverished society like the Gazan society is a form of collective punishment that is prohibited by Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which unconditionally disallows an occupying power to impose any kind of collective punishment on the population that is occupied. So there is really no basis for a claim of self-defense. In addition, when a government or a state occupies another people, it doesn't really have a right of self-defense. It has a right to protect its security in the occupation. But that security was being protected at the time of the attack. And if one looks at what ended the ceasefire, it was Israel's very provocative November 4th, 2008 attack within the Gaza Strip that killed at least six Palestinian so-called militants or members of Hamas, so that there were, it seems, other reasons why Israel didn't want this ceasefire to be prolonged, didn't want a diplomatic resolution of its relationship with Hamas, and chose a time while President Bush was still in office here and before Obama assumed the presidency to launch this Gaza offensive last winter. So it is, it seems to me very disturbing that our media in a society that prides itself on its freedom of expression has so totally bought into a false Israeli narrative about how the conflict began and why it began. And interestingly, even the Goldstone Report more or less adopts this false narrative and limits its investigation to whether the attacks were mindful of the restrictions in international humanitarian law on not attacking civilians and civilian targets, the so-called obligation to discriminate between military and non-military targets, and the issue of proportionality. They never look at the underlying question of whether Israel had any basis for initiating such a all-out attack in the first place.
I believe you mentioned that one of the conclusions or prescriptions of the Goldstone Report was the potentially bringing those guilty in Israel before the International Criminal Court. Does Israel recognize the International Criminal Court? Because I believe the U.S. does not.
Neither the U.S. nor Israel are parties to the Rome Treaty, which established the International Criminal Court, and do not themselves recognize the authority. But countries that are affected by the alleged war crimes are able to have them investigated, and if their nationals are victims, it is potentially possible to charge non-party leaders with responsibility. So one does not escape altogether the circle of responsibility by staying out of the Rome Treaty. There is this potential accountability. And there's a second way that Israeli military and political leaders can be prosecuted, and that is by way of what is called universal jurisdiction. Universal jurisdiction allows the criminal courts of countries to prosecute individuals who are in their territory for international crimes, even if they were committed outside their territory. Israel itself used this kind of authority to prosecute Adolf Eichmann back in 1962. Eichmann, people will remember or may recall, was the Nazi bureaucrat who organized the train schedules for the death camps during the Nazi period. He was abducted by Israeli security people in Argentina, brought back to Israel, and prosecuted for crimes committed in Germany before Israel even existed. And there was no objection. There was an objection to his abduction in a foreign country because that violated Argentinian sovereignty. But once they detained and prosecuted Eichmann, there was general acknowledgement that a sovereign state had the authority to prosecute individuals for crimes committed outside their territory. And this is a kind of legal universalism that has existed for a long time in relation to piracy. Wherever pirates are captured and whatever allegiance they may or may not have, they are subject to the prosecution of the detaining nation state. And so universal jurisdiction has been claimed in relation to war crimes by several of the European constitutional democracies, and and is arguably part of American law as well. So it has interfered with the travel schedule of some of the American leaders, for instance, Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger, are reluctant to travel to some of the countries that have this kind of universal jurisdiction. And now I'm pretty sure that Israeli military and political leaders will be reluctant. The most dramatic recent case was the Chilean dictator Pinochet, who was detained in Britain in 1998 because Spain wanted to prosecute him for crimes he committed in Chile while he was the dictator there. And the British judicial system eventually endorsed this Spanish claim, but decided that because Pinochet was not in sufficiently good health to stand trial, they would allow him to return to Chile, where he then did face some prosecutions. But in theory, at least, he could have been extradited to Spain for the criminal prosecutions, especially for torture committed during his the latter years of his dictatorship in Chile.
And that just happened a couple of years ago, is that right?
Yes, that happened in the period between about 1998 and 2002 or 3.
Okay. Just under 10 minutes left. If we could move over and talk about the current U.S. war in Afghanistan. We've been hearing now for a couple of weeks that the Obama administration is reconsidering its options there. What do you see as not really being covered in the corporate media on that subject?
Well, I think the media is considering it as an internal debate within the Obama administration whether to follow the McChrystal-Petraeus recommendations of an increase of 40,000 troops or to pursue a so-called counter-terrorist strategy seemingly advocated by the Vice President Joe Biden, which calls for more or less maintaining the existing troop level and concentrating mainly on avoiding Afghanistan from becoming a sanctuary for al-Qaeda in the future. Now, what is not in the debate and what puzzles me, especially after the U.S.'s experiences in Iraq and the earlier experience in Vietnam, is the difficulty bordering on impossibility of finding a military solution for a political conflict of this kind. The latter part of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century are very impressive in the degree to which they show that the politics of self-determination will eventually overcome a militarily superior intervention. In other words, military dominance doesn't any longer ensure the intervener of a successful political outcome. This was the real lesson of the Vietnam War, where the United States basically won every battle yet lost the war. And it's true to a lesser extent in Iraq, where an enormously disproportionate effort to control a relatively weak society has resulted in a great loss of blood and resources with very little assurance of about the political outcome. Now it seems we're reinventing counterinsurgency warfare for Afghanistan without thinking through the rationale. What's the threat posed by the Taliban? Their national movement, they threaten Afghan society with an oppressive regime, and one hopes that the Afghan people will challenge that regime. But is that really the work of the United States and its European allies? And suppose that Al-Qaeda does, to some degree, re-enter the picture in Afghanistan. Unless they are exterminated, they'll have to be somewhere in the world, and their threat is not a military threat. It's what I call a conceptual threat. The 9/11 attacks could have been planned in anyone's home, anywhere. It doesn't require weapons. It doesn't require much resources. All it requires are very dedicated individuals willing to sacrifice their lives and launching a plan that penetrates a complex modern society's security arrangements. So the notion that Al-Qaeda would be more threatening if it somehow had a base of operations in Afghanistan is a real unexamined notion. And if you take it too seriously, it would mean that the United States would have to be ready to intervene anywhere and everywhere in the world as soon as it sensed any penetration by hostile elements. What is, I think, at stake in Afghanistan is to reach an understanding that the security threats posed by the 9/11 attacks are essentially law enforcement threats that depend on police cooperation, intelligence, and the use of soft power mechanisms, not the use of military intervention and warfare. And until we learn that lesson, we're going to keep repeating the tragic errors of Vietnam and Iraq over and over again.
Some of the hawks are proposing relative U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan and using primarily missiles, you know, from afar, which seems to actually be what we're currently doing in Pakistan. Talk about that at all?
Well, I think that's, again, a new repackaging of counterinsurgency warfare that's trying to make it less politically unacceptable here in this society because it cuts American casualties. But the very nature of trying to pursue a zero-casualty war, which produces tremendous casualties on the target society, deepens anti-American resentment. Pakistan is probably the most anti-American society in the world at the present time, and the notion that we can somehow win the hearts and minds of people in countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan while we're killing their citizens and occupying their territory in one way or another, or keep propping up illegitimate governments, is one of the counterinsurgency illusions that we can't seem to get rid of, partly because our military budget is so exaggerated that we're not able to question whether this investment in a huge military machine can really produce greater security for the American people and, for that matter, for foreign society. So far, our reliance on military power since the end of the Cold War has been disastrous for us and catastrophic for those that have experienced it.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
We have just been talking with Richard Falk, the Albert G. Milbank Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and UN Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine. And his latest book, which you can find in bookstores, is Achieving Human Rights.